This morning's scripture is from the book of John, chapter 1, verses 43 through 51. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee, and he found Philip, and he said to him, "Follow me." Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, and the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is in no guile." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You shall see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man."
From Samuel. Now I've got to tell you, and I'll address this later in the message, but what you're hearing is kind of like moving into it'd be a good idea to read ahead of this passage so you really get the whole sense, but that was a lot of verses, so we're not going there. But there are two chapters that would have been good for us to know today. Let's listen to the words from Samuel. "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his own place. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called, 'Samuel, Samuel!' And he said, 'Here I am.' And he ran to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' But Eli said, 'I did not call. Lie down again.' So Samuel went and lay down. Then the Lord called again, 'Samuel.' And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' But Eli said, 'I did not call, my son. Lie down again.' Now Samuel did not know yet the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. And the Lord called Samuel the third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, 'Here I am, for you called me.' Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, 'Go, lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, Speak, Lord, for thy servant hears.' So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And the Lord came and stood forth, calling as other times, 'Samuel, Samuel.' And Samuel said, 'Speak, for thy servant hears.' Then the Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel, at which the two ears of everyone that hears it will tingle. On that day I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. And I will tell him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity which he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be expiated by sacrifice or offering forever." Samuel lay until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, and Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to God. But Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." And he said, "Here I am." And Eli said, "What was it he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also if you hide anything from all of that he told you." So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And Eli said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." And Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. Amen. In the summer of 1995, I graduated from seminary, officiated at my daughter's wedding, interviewed with South Avenue Baptist Church, accepted the call they offered, and my son Greg and I packed up a moving van and drove to Rochester from Indianapolis. For the first time in my life, I would move away from the state of my birth, my parents, and my children. But it was by choice. I was ready to live somewhere else than Indiana, even though I really hated leaving my children, but we survived. I came to Rochester because I wanted to serve a church in a city. I had chosen several regions in which I wanted to serve, and Rochester was one of them. No, I had never been here before, but I felt called. At least I called Carol Turner, the executive minister, once a month for 6 months for two reasons. One, I wanted him to get to know me so he could sell me to some church. And two, I wanted to know about the churches in the region. And because of those calls, he took pity on me, or he wanted me to stop calling. I don't really know. He encouraged South Avenue Baptist Church to interview me. A couple of interviews by the phone, two visits face-to-face, and ta-da, here I am in Rochester. During my time there, I wrote an article for a then newsletter called Net Results, and it was entitled, "The Light Hasn't Gone Out Yet." I told the story of our struggling congregation in the city and the hopes we had for the future. You know, we might have made it if the daycare that was providing a good chunk of the income hadn't gone under. Who knows? Anyway, with the help of the then executive minister, Ken Williams, we sold the building to the Greek Orthodox and kept my office in the building, but we worshiped at the Divinity School. Eventually, I accepted a call to serve as the associate minister at First Baptist Greater Cleveland, and a few years later, after doing their level best, South Avenue chose to close its doors. Did the light of God go out? No. The monies that were left in the coffers went to help others. To this day, scholarships are still given to Divinity School students in the name of South Avenue Baptist Church, and I know because I get the letter every year telling me about those. And monies went to Cameron Community Ministries. So the light of South Avenue Baptist Church continues today. Now, I'm not going to get to the gospel text. I thoroughly intended to, but that's not how the sermon wrote itself. So let's talk about Samuel and Eli. Like I said, if you could read the first two chapters, then maybe all of this will make more sense if you don't know it already, but I suspect many of you do. Samuel is living with Eli because his mother Hannah, who had given birth after years of infertility, loaned Samuel to the Lord through Eli the priest. Now, in our text, Samuel is sleeping in a room near the lamp of God, away from Eli when he hears that voice calling. Three times, young Samuel gets up to aging Eli to answer him. Two times, Eli tells him he's dreaming and go back to bed. How many parents have done that? On the third time, Eli figures what's going on, and he instructs Samuel to listen to what God has to say and then come back and tell him what the Lord has said. So he did. Like I said, what isn't in this chapter, but the chapter previous, is that Eli's son, also priests, are not living holy lives. They've taken more of than their share of the sacrifices, and they've taken advantage of vulnerable women who serve the temple. Eli has taken them to task before, but they have paid no attention to him. A man of God, he doesn't name names, but in chapter 2, a man of God has already spoken to Eli, telling him that his family lineage would not see old age, and that Eli too would pay a price because he did not control his sons. Now, I don't know how old Samuel is at this point, but when he sees Eli and has to tell him. He's telling him a hard, hard truth. He may be so young, really, that he doesn't even understand what he's telling Eli. But it isn't news to Eli because Eli's already heard this. But Eli does realize that God is doing something very important through Samuel. And because of Samuel's obedience, the light of God continues to burn, and Samuel became a prophet. The story of Samuel always forces me to think about my own life. When I was in active ministry, I always was to consider, let's think about that for a minute, what it meant for the church I was serving. Now, when I went to South Avenue Baptist Church, it was already a struggling church. I remember my new executive minister, who happens to be here today, took me out to lunch, and I said, you know, in seminary they always tell you, don't make any big changes for the first year. And Ken looked at me and said, you don't have a year. We also talked about football, which is how we got to be friends, and that goes on, but you know, so. But you did say that. My goal, I'm talking this in first person because these are my goals for what I had for the church. My goal was to be in ministry with 100 people each month. So I did a lot of things. I went on the board of the South Wedge Planning Committee. I visited the daycare a lot that was in the education wing. Marcia knows that wing well. And I had a sweatshirt made that said South Avenue Baptist Church on the front and Pastor Peg on the back, and I wore that all over the place, especially to the South Wedge festivals every year. When I arrived, the church, everybody parked in the parking lot and went in the back, the side door, and the front looked, a house that you've been to that it, you know that nobody goes in that front door? That your house? Okay, no. Oh, well, you have a very pretty front door here, so I'm not going there. But I got to say, the South Avenue front door looked like no one ever uses this door. So, and the landscaping out front was, okay, nothing. And so I just said one evening, okay, who's going to clean up the front yard with me? And people did, and we came, and we did a little landscaping. We cleaned it up, and then when weather was good, we left the front doors open. Because I had this fear that South Avenue is a walking neighborhood for a lot of people. And that if you're walking by and it doesn't look like anybody lives there, then who's going to come in the parking lot, you know? So we did that, and we got involved in neighborhood activities, and we even tried a Saturday night service, which we gave it a try. It was fun, and we gave it a try. But let's think about the lamp more. The lamp of God in the temple would have told them that the God is present. And if the light went out, they would have believed that God was no longer with them. So what does it mean to be the lamp of God? What does it mean to be the light? I think there are some exceedingly important things for us to think about. As individuals and as a community of faith, what does it mean for us, you and me, to be the light of God in the world? Two stories. Ken and I watched the Christmas special for the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Did anybody else see it on PBS? Yes. Okay, you already know the story. If you have not, you'll want to. Neither of us had ever heard of Nicholas Winton before, but David Suchet, Poirot, for the mystery junkies, Nicholas Winton was a British humanitarian who saved the lives of at least 669 children during World War II. He formed the children's section of the British Committee for Refugees from Czechoslovakia with other volunteers and coordinated the country's Kinder Transport operation. The program was set up by the British government in 1938 to allow unaccompanied Jewish children under the age of 17 to stay in the UK with a foster family as long as they secured £50 to guarantee their eventual return ticket. Evacuation efforts were already running, going on between Germany and Austria, but not Czechoslovakia, until Winton came along, who, with others, chipped in to cover the cost of those children. went through endless red tape, and occasionally forged a few travel documents and bribed officials. Unapologetically, let's say. From the spring of 1939 to the start of the war, hundreds of children, most of them Jewish, left their parents to get on that train to travel from Prague to Liverpool Street station in London, then crossing Netherlands and Germany, and before taking a ferry from Hook of Holland. Each child was given this identity tag with their name and a number hanging around their neck. A few of the parents made it to England, but most didn't. So most of these children were never reunited with their families. Most of them stayed with foster families. Now here's the thing. I couldn't have done this, but he did. He never talked about his role in helping these children. Nobody knew about this, not even his wife, until she found his scrapbook in the attic 50 years later. She gave the scrapbook to a researcher who put the story together, and eventually he was honored for his contribution and met some of the children he had helped to save. He's called Britain's Oscar Schindler. He was knighted by the Queen. And here's something I didn't know from the show, was One Life is a movie about his life that came out last year. And if I ever find out where to watch it, I'll let you know. But Sir Anthony Hopkins plays Sir Nicholas Winton. I don't know about you, I'm very unlikely to bring around that kind of dramatic contribution to the world. But we can do other things. Second story. When I moved to Rochester in 1995, I lived in a small cottage in the South Wedge in a house in somebody's backyard. You know those houses? Okay. It didn't have a washer or dryer, so I went to the laundromat. And so one time there, I started talking to this young woman with her little girl, and we chatted about life and all sorts of things. I think I invited her to church, but I can't really remember. But I never expected to see her again. In this backyard, the house next door, is a young family, mom, dad, three little kids. Mom had just had a baby and was dealing with such severe postpartum depression, she was hospitalized. So it was a while before I met her. I'd met Joe, her husband. But it was through his wife that I met her young friend, Marty, the young woman from the laundromat. And I must have invited him to church at some point, because they started coming. Now, I might have done the inviting, probably, but I didn't keep them there. The people kept them there. They had stories. They had burdens. They had issues. And they were welcomed. And we loved having their children. We loved having these children in the congregation who would just light up rooms. Now, I've lost touch with them many years later, but I believe that the light of South Avenue Baptist Church still lives in them at some level or another. You don't come into somebody's life without making a change. And I think we made a good one. So we don't have to be the Wintons or the Schindlers of the world to be the light of God in our world. It's about being present. It's about being available. It's about being kind and open to the possibilities that God can bring as an individual and as a community of faith. We can be, and I know you are, right now the light in somebody's life. As a community of faith, as a small group of people, as individuals, we make a difference. We change the world. We can be the presence of Jesus, and we will feel the presence of Jesus in our own lives. Let me close with words from Dr. King. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. You may be the light someone needs to survive. Amen.